Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Matthias Hontjens, co-author with Pierre de Gioia Carabellesi of European Banking and Financial Law, the second edition of which was published in 2020 by Routledge. As the writers make clear in the introduction to the second edition of this textbook, an update was urgently needed after 5 years. A wave of legislation had been initiated after the 2008 financial crisis, but took years to negotiate, implement, and make itself felt in markets that had also been transformed by the crisis itself and by technological change. The other enormous change since the first edition in 2015, and one that is still a big open question for financial lawyers and practitioners alike, is the City of London's departure from the European Economic Area last month. Matthias Hontjens is Professor of Law at the University of Leiden and a deputy judge in the District Court of Amsterdam. He obtained his PhD from the University of Amsterdam and was a visiting researcher at Harvard, NYU, and the University of Paris. Matthias, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
I said in the introduction that an update was needed, but who was the first mover? Was it you and your co-writer or Routledge? And secondly, what was your target readership in 2015, and how successful have you been in reaching it over the last 5 years?
Well, thanks for that question. Who was the first mover? I guess we were for the second edition, certainly. And that has also has to do with how we came about writing the first edition. Because as you said in the introduction, after the financial crisis, an enormous amount of legislation from the European level has been adopted. And what you saw in the years afterwards, that in universities across Europe, courses had been developed which dealt with EU financial law as a separate topic, and sometimes even as a separate course or separate master program. There are universities now who have a full year program on EU financial law and financial law even more generally. So that's why we came up in the, during the financial crisis, actually, to write a textbook specifically for that purpose, for EU financial law courses. And we wanted to draft it rather quickly to answer that need, which we saw in various universities. So we drafted this book, and then Routledge approached us asking, well, what would you think of writing a textbook? And then, well, the two things came together and we rather quickly wrote the book and it was published. And we said to ourselves, well, we did this rather quickly to answer to the demand in the market that we saw. But, you know, after a couple of years, then obviously we would have real life classroom experience and also the, as you said correctly, a lot of new developments would have occurred. So that prompted us to write the second edition to address things that came up during the last years, both in the classroom and outside of it.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of every chapter, you have these questions, sort of five or so questions. Are they questions that came up in your teaching over the last 5 years, and that's why you put them in there?
Yes, that's right. They came up, but also they came up from the students, but also from us. So that's also what we wanted to quiz our students about, ask them and check whether they understood, to check their progress and what they thought of the topic, to make them think further about the topic. So these questions have, you could say, a double purpose. First, to check whether you've understood what's the topic, but also to incite you to think a bit further and to assess critically on what you have learned. Mm.
One of the things I like is before you launch into each detailed into the detailed law in each chapter, you begin with minimal assumed knowledge about the financial instruments and the history of the lawmaking process. When you're teaching the book, does that take up a lot of time, or are students expected to read and internalize those basics before they come to your lectures?
Yeah, well, that depends a bit on the level that you're teaching. So this book is really meant as an introductory book to financial markets, to financial law, more specifically to EU financial law. So naturally, we assumed basic knowledge to be rather minimal. And that's also where we saw that there is a lack in, well, was a lack in what was out there. So most books on financial law, they assume a lot of knowledge and they immediately go very deep into the problems they want to tackle, but they skip that first part. And I have found out that myself the hard way, because, well, when I started to specialize in this area 15, 20 years ago, there was no such book, and I've always found that difficult to have, you know, not a nice introductory book where things are brought together. So it depends a bit on the level that you're teaching. So sometimes when we teach undergraduate level, then you would naturally take some more time to discuss those very basic issues. But when you're teaching in a more advanced level, you can skip that and leave that more, well, assume that to be known already. Although I think that's what teaching has taught me. Never assume too much knowledge from the perspective of the audience. It's always a good thing to start with the basics, so that you're all on the same page, especially with a technical topic such as this one. Yeah.
Well, it really struck me that one of the themes running through the book is how far ahead the US has been in this field. For example, you identify this in when you're talking about establishing prospectus standards, and most notably when it came to policing market abuse. The gap there was something like 50 years. So you seem to suggest that the Europeans, or many Europeans, had a cultural view that professional investors didn't require protection. Do you think that was at the root of this difference?
Yes, that may have to do with it. I'm not so sure about cultural differences that lie at the basis of it. At Leiden, we also teach Anglo-American financial law, so we also study the differences between the European market and the American markets. And what we see time and again as a cause of differences is that the US markets have always been very much geared towards capital markets financing of companies. So companies in the US tend to finance themselves by issuing bonds on the market, whereas in the European tradition is a bank financed model, where companies finance their activities by having bank loans. And this has various consequences. I think also for this topic that you're now addressing. So the capital US capital markets have for this reason always been deeper and more advanced. And that may also have been the reason why they were far ahead with thinking about how to organize capital markets and protect investors through the law. I think that may also have a lot to do with it, with that particular difference that you now address.
And do you think the recent Wirecard case suggests that the European authorities at the EU and national level, or EU or national level, still don't take this as seriously as the Americans, perhaps for some of the reasons you set out there? And does this require additional legislation or a change in business culture or reprioritizing funding into the regulators?
Yes, that's very interesting. Well, I think the jury is still out there on what caused this, why this has happened, and what would be the best remedy against it. I'm not sure whether this would not have happened or doesn't happen in the US. I do think that this Wirecard scandal may also have to do with the more fragmented supervisory setup in the EU. I mean, in the US, there is a fragmented, also a certain type of fragmentation of supervisory structure, that you have numerous various agencies who all have their specific remit as to the supervision of financial markets in the US. But you do, but it's mainly on the federal level. I think there is a lot of integration and a lot of attention also to supervision and enforcement on the federal level, and especially where it regards money laundering, that it has been lacking in the EU, that is on the supranational level, and that is very much now on the agenda of the European institutions to fill that gap and to create a European anti-money laundering agency, so that these cross-border issues are effectively tackled on a supranational level. And that may also have been something that lies at the root of this specific scandal.
Yeah. Moving on to banking. On balance, how successfully do you think the European Banking Union process is going? Do you think it'll only be truly successful when a strong, well-capitalized bank is allowed or feels secure enough to buy a weak, cheap bank in another EBU country?
Yes, that could certainly be a evidence of that. Unfortunately, I don't think that would be that should not be the benchmark. I mean, what we've seen before the global financial crisis, and maybe what may have caused it to a certain extent, is that also banks did take over other banks in other jurisdictions, even if it concerned a less capitalized bank taking over another bank. We've seen numerous or various examples of that. I do think that it would be evidence of a success of the banking union when banks would be sufficiently capitalized, have a strong capital structure. On that point, I definitely agree. And maybe it would be a it would be a, I think it will be very interesting to see what happens now with this terrible pandemic that we've seen going on now. Until now, of course, well, Primarily, it's a health crisis, of course, but this is now morphing into an economic crisis. And it may also, and various commentators have suggested that, may also morph into a financial crisis. And that, I think, will be a real test for the banking union and the new rules that have been adopted in the wake of the previous financial crisis, whether the European banking system is now strong enough to shoulder those losses and to weather that storm of this of the pandemic and the economic crisis that ensues. So I think that will be a real test first, and then also, you know, it is inevitable that banks fail, even if you have the strongest supervisory structure and the harshest capital requirements. It is inevitable that banks fail, and I think a crucial test will also be whether banks will be allowed or will be able to fail in an orderly manner, and resolution can be done efficiently and adequately. And I think that will be also be a big test. And well, we've now talked about supervision. That's what's called the first pillar. And well, the second pillar is then a sufficient resolution regime, which has been set up. But the third pillar is still lacking. And that is a common deposit guarantee scheme. And what you see now was just the other day that the European Commission has relaunched an initiative to come up with exactly that, a sort of common deposit guarantee scheme or something similar to that. So that's still lacking, but many feel that's urgently needed as as the last pillar, the last component of the banking union, which is necessary to make it really successful.
Yes, ironically, the deposit guarantee scheme is something that hasn't changed at all since you wrote the first edition, because that idea has been knocking around, really going back to the financial crisis, and very little progress has been made. I'm glad you raised the issue of resolution, because it's very striking that this very ambitious directive, the Bank Recovery and Resolution Directive, was passed early in the decade, and markets felt that they had a clear understanding of how and when banks should be resolved in the hierarchy of losses. But in fact, it was only applied a couple of times. Banco Popular in 2017, for example, when it came to a proper political challenge, like with the Venetian banks, ways were found around of not applying the BRRD. So how, you know, do you think this lack of clarity about resolution is a problem, and that when something like this happens again, politics will not intervene?
Yeah, that's a very interesting and highly important issue you raise. I think, you know, the capitalization, or the financing, I should say, of a bank failure is, you know, that is the core of a well-functioning or of any functioning resolution regime. And indeed, after the global financial crisis, the new resolution regimes have been adopted. And the bail-in mechanism, under which private financiers of a bank shoulder the losses, so shareholders and bondholders, they should shoulder the losses rather than having taxpayers pay the bill. So that bail-in mechanism had been heralded as the new mechanism that would make everything different, but reality has proven to be more difficult than that. And what you have seen, indeed, and you rightly refer to these Italian banks, as an example of where this bail-in mechanism was considered to be politically unacceptable, so that bailout, so taxpayer money put in was resorted to. And there are various interesting aspects to this. I think, well, one aspect of it is that in these specific cases also, or in Italian case, what you saw is that banks had sold bonds that then were subject to bail-in to retail investors. And it was considered to be unacceptable that these clients, these retail investors who were put under pressure by the bank itself to buy these bonds, were then subjected to bail-in, and this problem then should be resolved, I think, by having stricter rules on how to sell these type of bonds, but this has more to do with conduct supervision and rules for conduct than prudential or resolution rules. But what you will see is, and I think this also will happen in the economic crisis that we're now going on, is that in several instances, states will feel compelled to step in and keep companies from, whether that be a bank or another company, from falling over, because the consequences of such a failure would be harsher and more destructive than having it kept afloat by taxpayer money. So it is a bit mixed picture, I think. What I think is good is that the bank recovery and resolution regime, the directive that we now have in place, does allow for certain ways of government intervention. So, unlike, for instance, under U.S. law, there is a prohibition on state recapitalization. We do not have that in the European legislation. So I think the European legislation does allow for some flexibility and does allow states to step in at certain in certain circumstances, but that should not be the default rule. And indeed, we've only seen one big bank now being resolved under the resolution regime. I have hopes, good hopes, that it will be repeated, but there are some issues that might need to be addressed. So in other areas maybe, such as when it concerns certain conduct supervision, but also that there may be also economic circumstances in which it will become inevitable for a state to step in.
Does that answer a bit your question? Yes, no, it did.
Go ahead.
Sorry, you cut out for a second there. A similar case is the case of the large exposure regime. And you mention this in the book. You say this regime is, quote, riddled with exceptions, discretions, and supervisory decisions, reducing its usefulness as a risk-reducing factor. Now, the obvious one of these is that it doesn't cover home state sovereign bonds. But what are some, well, A, how would you like to see that resolved? And B, what are some of these other issues, exceptions, discretions, and supervisory decisions you're referring to?
Yeah, so a lot of these European instruments, they allow for exceptions or discretions. And from the one hand, that has to do with wishing to leave it up to national member states to mold the instrument to a specific national market, But also, on the other hand, it has to do with having the discretion to apply the rules proportionate to the to the financial institution under supervision. So there are a lot of exceptions and supervisory discretions, or room for that in the instruments. And on the one hand, that is difficult also for the markets and for the financial institutions under supervision, who sometimes prefer a hard and fast rule over more flexible rules, because that gives less certainty. But on the other hand, it does give the supervisory authorities room to apply it in a proportionate way in a specific circumstance. So there are two ways to look at it, and well, specifically on this matter, you see a bit this phenomenon also reflected in this in the large exposure regime.
Yeah, and is there do you have a preferred solution to dealing with this home state sovereign bond issue, this idea of the doom loop between the state and the home registered banks?
Yes, this is very difficult knot to untangle, and it certainly does not help that banks have an incentive to take on a lot of government debt on the balance sheet, because there is this favorable supervisory treatment of it, so that surely doesn't help. There are also other ways other instruments that try to disentangle the knot, to break the knot between government finances and the financial sector or the banking sector. Well, for one, the resolution regime that we've just talked about, if you have a well-functioning resolution regime where losses can be borne to an important extent by shareholders and other creditors, and there is a credible regime in place for orderly liquidation, that would surely help to disentangle the knot, so that states do not have to step in and nationalize a bank, for instance, when it falls over. So there are various ways to address the issue, and well, one of the obvious solutions also would be to the specific issue that you just referred to, is to take away the specific incentive of this favorable capital treatment for banks of government debt. But that, of course, is a very difficult political issue to tackle, because there is a clearer interest in for governments, for the European member states, to be able to issue government debt under favorable commercial conditions. So, and I would guess that in the current environment, where billions of euros are poured into the economic system, in our markets, to keep everything a bit afloat, so there will be immense pressure on state finances. So I would be surprised if this, if maybe this specific element would change very soon.
Yes, again, that's one that's been knocking around in my memory for a couple of decades, so I won't hold my breath. In the book, you identify two laws, the 2002 Directive on Financial Collateral Arrangements and the 2009 Regulation on Credit Ratings Agencies, as stretching the boundaries of EU lawmaking. The first was, quote,
a rare instance where the EU has harmonized national property and insolvency law. And the second you describe as extraordinary because it provided direct grounds for civil liability. Can you expand on this and how this came about?
Yes. Well, what's interesting, I think, is that the mandate of the European legislator has always been very narrowly defined, where you see instruments being adopted, especially in the earlier ones, they're always very, very specific, targeting a specific issue, a specific problem in the financial markets. But you see more and more that how difficult it is to address a specific topic in a certain area of law without having to take into account the consequences this has on bordering areas of law in a specific member state. And this specifically concerns directives which are implemented into member states' laws. This may sound a bit abstract, but what I mean is that, for instance, you can regulate something about, well, let's say a certain transaction, but when you regulate that and that is then implemented into a member state law, then elements of that member state contract law and property law may be also of relevance and may shape the implementation of the European instrument in that specific instance. So then you might end up with different implementation, different member states anyway. So that's what you see, and especially that regards instruments which have a private law aspect. So the European legislator has always been reluctant to legislate on issues of property law, especially and exactly for this very purpose, because this is felt to be such a deeply ingrained issue in the systems of member states' private laws. So what's interesting, especially about this financial collateral directive, is that it does address issues of property law, albeit in the specific area of collateral finance transactions. But what you see is that because it has taken this bold step to regulate issues of property law, you see these different implementations across member states, as I just described. So I think that's a very, very interesting example. The other example that you refer to is the credit rating agency regulation, which is another example of where you have an instrument, a provision of private law that has been adopted on the European level. And usually what you see is that issues of tort law also are left to the member states. But in this instance, you have a direct ground for civil liability on the European level in this credit rating agency regulation. It's Article 35A. And this is a provision, an article that parties can invoke before their national courts when they wish to initiate a claim for damages against a credit rating agency. And this is a rare example of a provision of private law that has been adopted on the European level, which allows parties in member states to invoke this European provision before the national courts within the context of their own national law.
Do you know why that was? Was it because the ratings agencies were so cross-border in character?
That's a very, very interesting question. I think maybe the political backgrounds of the two instruments were a bit different. I think collateral transactions have been considered to be highly important for the functioning of the European markets, and also they play a very important role in the monetary policy of European central banks. So there was a clear reason to regulate also on a European level this type of transactions. And on the, which is I think a bit different when you compare it to the credit rating agency regulation, which was triggered in part by the global financial crisis, I think, where a lot of, well, it has been considered to be, the crisis is considered to be by many to have been maybe not caused, but indeed deepened by credit rating agencies, which did not always properly rate certain instruments that lie at the root of the crisis. So there was for that reason an incentive to regulate credit rating agencies, and there was also an idea that it would be good that also European credit rating agencies would enter the market, and for that reason it was thought a pan-European system of liability would be a good idea. So I think, yeah, I agree with you. But you say, well, there is a specific and a deeply felt or it was seen there is a lot of cross-border activity, especially going on in these two areas, but also the incentives, the policy goals have been a bit different when you look at the two instruments. But again, the cross-border activity, the cross-border nature of the type of activity that's regulated by the two instruments, was indeed an important factor.
Well, winding up with Brexit, you know, the big change since your first edition. Apart from not wanting to accept free movement, the British government rejected continued passporting of financial services because it wanted the freedom to diverge in financial law. I've only been able to identify two or three areas where I think realistically the British could or would want to diverge. Do you have any ideas where it would be advantageous for the UK to diverge in financial law?
Well, that's a difficult one.
You get a consultant's fee, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what you can see, and what's been very much on the mind of the European Commission too, is that also in negotiations to the very last moment, from the European side, they wish to avoid is the UK having a lighter type of regulation, where it may be more advantageous for financial firms to engage in business under UK supervision rather than under EU regulation. So there will be from a competition standpoint, an area so close to the EU where you would have it, well, very attractive for financial firms to do their business without having to comply with these all these burdensome rules that have been promulgated on the European level. So that has been a great concern, especially if those firms would then which then would be under a lighter regime would be allowed to provide their services on the continent, and that's what was called the integrity of the internal market issue, which has been so contentious. But yeah, to come up, to answer your question, to think of an area where it would be, where it would be, well, advantageous for the UK to do things differently. That's a difficult one. Apart from the more general comment I just made. Considering the requirements for accessing the European markets, there is this equivalence mechanism where the European Commission grants access to the EU financial markets if the home state has an equivalent type of regulation supervision. So that could be also an incentive for the UK to stay at least similar to the European rule. So that could also be consideration when thinking about where to diverge from EU existing laws and regulations. Ironically, of course, the UK has always been very influential in shaping the European rules, the EU rules, especially where it regards EU financial law, and that influence is now gone. So, where does that leave the UK? I don't know. I saw that immediately. I was involved in some legislative process in Brussels at the time, and it was, you know, the change was immediately felt in the dynamics in Brussels conference rooms.
Since this is a books network, I ask every guest to recommend a book at the end of the podcast. What have you chosen and why?
This is a difficult question. There are so many books I really like to read, not only financial law books, but certainly also other books. I thought I'd just go for books that I'm reading at the moment. So a book that I'm reading at the moment is Stalingrad by Vasily Grossman, mm-hmm. And that's one of two books he wrote, Life and Fate. That's really a very well-known book. It concerns also the siege of Stalingrad, and it has been dubbed the modern day War and Peace by Tolstoy. I was very much impressed with Life and Fate. I liked it a lot. Found it really a moving book. It's a huge book, but it's fantastic. And that's why I also now am reading the book that was intended to go together. So it's really a two book project has been that. So now I'm reading Stalingrad, and he knows how to write a story, to tell a story. It's deeply human. It's moving. All these various characters. I think it's fantastic. And also, it's interesting because he witnessed everything firsthand. He was a doctor, I think, a medic, traveling with the Red Army at the time. If you allow me, there was also another book which I'm now avidly, reading is also a good word, but it's maybe using is more apt, because it's a cookbook. I like to cook, and this has been given much impetus now by the pandemic and having to do everything at home. I really like Giorgio Locatelli, an Italian chef who has a famous restaurant in London. He has made this book Made at Home, and I think it's a fantastic book. The subtitle is The Food I Cook for the People I Love, and it's great. You have all these various Italian recipes. Sometimes they're quite complex, but now, you know, with being at home, I have finally dared to take up this cookbook. So that's another one, if you allow me to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Is that a new book that came out during the lockdown, or is that an older book?
It is a somewhat older book. I think it came out 2017, but I saw it again marketed in the bookshops. Yeah, online, of course. Yeah,
the lockdown edition. Yeah.
Indeed.
Okay, well, today I've been talking to Matthias Huntjens about his European Banking and Financial Law, published last year in its second edition. Matthias, thank you again for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.